The climate is changing. So are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, April the 21st on CBC Radio. David Sanger says we have entered an era of new cold wars. The veteran White House and security correspondent joins me first up to chart how conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine and U.S. relations with China and Russia are reshaping our world. After that, isn't it about time you call your parents? But not just to shoot the breeze. As our guest will tell you, we need to talk about aging, and she's got some tips to help cut down on the discomfort. Also on the program, Romeo Dallaire is tired of truces. The retired Canadian Lieutenant General will make his appeal for lasting peace amid today's conflicts, 30 years after genocide devastated Rwanda. And later on, what's at stake for the world's largest democracy and beyond as nearly 1 billion voters head to the polls in India? It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. The world held its breath for much of the past week as the tit-for-tat exchange of attacks between Israel and Iran played out. The latest escalation between the longtime adversaries began at the start of this month with an airstrike on the Iranian consulate in Syria that many believe was the work of the Israeli military. It was followed by a retaliatory barrage of drones and missiles from Iranian soil on Israel itself. Then, this past Friday, Israel responded with a limited attack inside of Iran. It has all made for a very tense situation that David Sanger, the veteran White House and national security correspondent for the New York Times, has been watching closely. And David's been taking stock of a new era of geopolitics that seems to be dawning across the globe. His new book is called New Cold Wars: China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. I spoke with David Sanger on Thursday before Israel's latest salvo against Iran, and I began our conversation by asking him just how dangerous a direct conflict between Israel and Iran would be for the world.
The change in the nature of the China-Russia-Iran partnership is that we have now seen the fruits of a reordered world. 9 years ago, during the Iran nuclear negotiations, which ended in 2015 with an agreement between Iran and the Obama administration, the Russians and the Chinese were on the U.S. and European side of the negotiating table in Vienna. I was covering those talks for a year and a half, and the Russians were enormously helpful in that conversation. They even, at the end of the day, took almost all of Iran's enriched uranium and blended it down and kept it in Russia. Couldn't be any more useful than that. Iran suddenly didn't have enough fuel to produce a bomb. Unimaginable that that would happen today when Russia is dependent on Iran for the Shahed drones, the same drones you saw heading to Israel, and when Russia is negotiating with Iran for ballistic missiles, the same kind of ballistic missiles you saw fired at Israel. And so right now we're in a world that is beginning to harden with a U.S. NATO group that is drawing sort of a new Iron Curtain somewhere around Ukraine, and a Russia, China, Iran, North Korea group that is trying to draw in new allies, particularly in Asia. And then a group of countries that are saying, don't make us choose, India being among them. And that's getting to be an increasingly difficult place to be.
Let me pick up on a couple things you said there. You talked about the Russia-Iran relationship, you know, kind of more, well, historically, but not that long ago. You pointed out after Iran's attack on Israel last weekend, when President Biden got world leaders together on the call, we also have like the Zoom photo of that, to discuss the situation, there were two notable absences, China and Russia. How significant is that?
Well, those are the two countries with the most influence on Iran. If you looked at that picture of the video, you know, it was intended to show unity, and there was unity, but every one of those countries was doing sanctions of some form on Iran or not buying their oil. They were already on one side of this, and their influence over the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps or the mullahs in Iran was about zero. So, it was, you know, a nice display for the cameras, but I'm much more interested in what the president can do to get countries that Iran might listen to say, hey, it really is time to step back on this.
And so what do you think he can do? Who does he reach out to? Who is he reaching out to?
Well, clearly they are talking to the Iranians in sort of smoke signals through the Omanis and through the Swiss. And that's important. At the same time, Israel was taken by surprise by the size of the Iranian reaction. They did not think that the attack on these seven Iranian Revolutionary Guard commanders was going to prompt a major retaliation. And they didn't think of it as as the straw that would break the back. And it turned out that it did. So it's those kinds of misjudgments that can trip you into wars over time. Misjudgments about where red lines are.
You are a veteran White House journalist, and you have traveled the globe with five American presidents. And, you know, as we talk about the big players in all this, China, Russia, India, the United States, I want to kind of go back to the early 2000s. This, of course, is when George W. Bush is elected president. You open your book with a story about traveling with him to Russia. This is taking place in 2002. And it was a time, and it's hard maybe for people to think of a time, given the enmity between the United States and Russia. But it was a time when the United States was attempting to bring Russia into the fold as an economic and security partner. What was the thinking back then of how and why this friendship, this partnership, whatever we're going to call it, could and should happen? How was it going to work?
Well, the way it was going to work was pretty simple, that Russia, which had seen, of course, all the old Soviet states dissolve away after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and had seen some sign on to NATO, the alliance created to contain the old Soviet Union, was going to come to the determination that democracy was sort of the end of history, as Francis Fukuyama famously put it, but more importantly, that Russia's economic future was going to rely almost entirely on its continued sale of oil and gas to the rest of the world, but particularly to Europe. And of course, that is not what happened as it played out. But in 2002, in the scene that you are mentioning, Pia, there was this remarkable evening on the Neva River, just outside of St. Petersburg. We were all on these large sort of yachts that were floating down the Neva. I was in the press pool at the time, and just ahead of us was a yacht with George and Laura Bush and Putin and his then wife. And, you know, there was music coming out and food flowing. It was this sort of hulking guy in the background who was serving the food. Turns out, of course, it was Yevgeny Prigozhin, who, you know, later reappears in the book as a very different character, the one who then goes on to create the Internet Research Agency and tried to influence the 2016 election in favor of then-candidate Donald Trump. And then, of course, creates the Wagner Group mercenary crowd. And then when he gets disillusioned with Putin and his defense forces, does a march on Moscow.
And then ends up dead.
Yeah, he's no longer with us. As you recall, he stepped on the wrong airplane. But none of that was evident at the moment that he was serving dinner on the Neva. And during this float down the river, they're talking about Russia joining the European Union because it's truly a European country, and maybe one day Russia joining NATO. When you look at this now and the 24 other meetings between George W. Bush and Putin, it seems like it's from another world. Hmm. I mean, President Biden has met Putin in office exactly once in Geneva in June of 2021 in a meeting in an effort to stop the ransomware attacks on the United States that had a brief warning about how the U.S. would stand with Ukraine. This is before the invasion, of course. That will probably be the first and last meeting these two men ever have as president.
Okay, so given that backdrop, when Russia invades Ukraine in 2022, so some 20 years after that, you know, that the boat in Russia, but at a time when the West was trying to bring Russia into the fold. Fast forward those 20 years and Russia invades Ukraine. Western leaders were shocked by this. Should they have been?
No, they should not. There's a chapter in the book called The 7-Year Itch. It is not a reference to Marilyn Monroe's favorite famous movie. It's a reference to the fact that in 2007, Putin showed up at the Munich Security Conference and gave a speech in public in front of the cameras in which he said, there are parts of Russia that have been taken away from us that need to come back. And clearly he meant Ukraine among them. And he talked about the Russia of Peter the Great, whose bust sits, of course, in Putin's office. There are no old pictures or busts of old Soviet leaders in Putin's office. He thinks they were all idiots who gave too much authority to the rest of the socialist Soviet republics. But there is one to Peter the Great, pretty clear how he envisions his own role. The defense secretary at the time, Bob Gates, stood up and gave a brief response in which he said, look, I've been through one Cold War. No one needs a second one. But we fundamentally ignored what Putin said and thought, you know, at the end of the day, he'll complain a lot, but he needs the money, right? And then in 2014, 7 years later, he takes Crimea, a part of Ukraine. The West spends a year arguing about sanctions. And then following year, in 2015, the Germans signed the Nord Stream 2 pipeline deal, bringing billions of dollars to Russia and constructing the pipeline around Ukraine so the Ukrainians will get no revenue. And Merkel calls Putin a reliable supplier. So if you're Vladimir Putin, Pia, what are you supposed to conclude other than, sure, the Americans will complain a lot when we take over all of Ukraine, but at the end of the day, they're really not going to do anything.
In your book, David Sanger, you write that the war in Ukraine, that the conflict is regional, but the stakes are global. If Russia claims a victory or a partial victory here in the coming months, what are the global stakes and what happens to Ukraine?
There are two ways to look at the Ukraine conflict if you're sitting in the U.S. Congress or you're a NATO ally. One of them is we are aiding Ukraine because they're a burgeoning democracy. And therefore, we ought to stand with them, even if they're not a NATO member. The other way to look at it, the argument that President Biden has made explicitly is you're aiding Ukraine because you've got to stop Russia there. If it takes Ukraine, it's only a matter of time before they test a NATO country, and then we're into a much bigger conflict. Essentially, the 1930s option, right? That the historical analogy here is when the U.S. allowed aggression in the 30s as Hitler took over different parts of Europe. And where you stand on this debate may depend on what historical analogy you are using. The other thing to think about is that the Chinese are watching everything that we do in Ukraine and measuring it by the yardstick of, if they will not do this for Ukraine, what will they do or not do for Taiwan?
And what is your answer to that question when you look at what China is seeing and what it might do in Taiwan?
Well, there's a lot of time spent on the Taiwan and China questions in the book. You know, Russia's the more urgent problem, but China's obviously the long-running one. Or as one person I quote in the book says, you know, Russia is the hurricane, but China is climate change. And my answer to this is that the Taiwan issue will move at sort of climate change, not hurricane pace, which is to say, I don't think that the Chinese are going to take on the Taiwan problem while their economy is slowing down dramatically. And they're now down to closer to 3% growth, because sanctions from the world applied to a country that's already in slowdown are a lot more painful than sanctions to a country that's growing at 8 or 9% a year, what the Chinese were used to. But I also argue that the Silicon Shield in Taiwan, which is to say the shield created by the fact that Taiwan Semiconductor produces 95% of the world's most advanced semiconductors, and we need them, but the Chinese also need them, is a diminishing asset over time. And that as China gets better and better at producing semiconductors, something the United States is trying to slow their progress on by prohibiting the export of the most advanced semiconductor equipment. As China gets better, the space between them and Taiwan Semiconductor is going to diminish. And to them, the cost of invading Taiwan may also diminish.
You know, you mentioned India. India, of course, Indians have started going to the polls in, you know, elections. We'll be talking about that later on our show. And as you say, India's going to have to figure out what its path going forward is. Modi will likely, assuredly, win another election. But the other election that everyone is keeping eyes on in 2024 is one in your country in November. The U.S. has always had a very big foreign policy agenda. But I have to say, David, you know, in my 50 years on the planet, I can't think of like so many intersecting and difficult files for President Biden. In November, what does another term for Biden mean for these new Cold Wars? And what about if Trump wins?
Well, first, we'll start with Biden. You know, Biden hates the phrase Cold War. He came out and said in his first speech to the United Nations as president that he does not desire a new Cold War. And there are people in the administration who are not wild about the title of my book. But I think that as time has gone on, we have seen that some of the similarities to the old Cold War are evident. And obviously, we're engaged in a struggle, not an ideological one, but a struggle. And we're engaged in a conflict that involves two major superpowers and then side players like Iran, as we discussed, which makes this much more complicated and, I would argue, much more volatile and dangerous than the old Cold War. There was a predictability to the old Cold War. We knew the Soviets. We knew who ran them. We knew who had control over their nuclear weapons. Once you have two major countries involved and working together, you have a lot more unpredictability in the system. And that means you need to manage it all the more subtly. I think that Biden has done a fairly good job with a really bad hand in trying to manage that. He's had some bad moments. Afghanistan has been one. I would say trying to deal with the Israelis on Gaza would clearly be a second. For former President Trump, you know, his constant effort to strike one trade deal after another or do something that he thought was in his immediate interest does not lend itself to a long-term strategy for dealing with this. And so it's no wonder that the Russians and the Chinese might well prefer him.
And as you said, in an unpredictable world, some predictability of leaders everywhere might give us more of a signal of where they can manage these conflicts. But David Sanger, again, you know, you've covered the White House and global events for many, many years. And I think for people listening to this on a Sunday morning, a lot of people are just nervous about the state of the world, scared. Like when we hear you, it sounds pretty freaking bad. So how are you thinking about this? Like, how do you calm your nerves, or do you have nerves to be calmed?
Well, you know, I look at friends of mine from, you know, college who are, you know, emergency room doctors, and I think, God, I could never go do that. It would completely freak me out. But the geopolitics of it does not keep me particularly awake at night, because America and the world have been through much tougher times, the 30s, which we described. The pre-war period leading up to our entry into World War I. Much more complicated. It's just that for 30 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall and in a period of the American unipower moment, we kind of had a holiday from history. And people did not need to really think in geopolitical terms. And, you know, universities stopped running courses on nuclear deterrence, which was a big deal in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Protesters didn't come out about nuclear disarmament, which was a big issue in the 70s and 80s. And they didn't because they viewed that we were in this period of kind of, you know, permanent peace. It turned out it was a false peace. And I think what we are coming back to is something more close to the norm. I don't want it by in saying that in any way to diminish the dangers. In fact, I wrote this book to try to wake people into the fact that in returning to this norm, we have to think again about what our interests are around the globe. And frankly, one of the conclusions I come to is that the United States, Canada, the other G7 countries, it's not as if we can draw up big walls around and say, we're just going to let the rest of the world deal with this and use the oceans as our barriers here, because that plain old doesn't work. It doesn't work. It didn't work before the cyber age. It really doesn't work in the cyber age.
Well, that's somewhat reassuring, David, and I appreciate you ending with us on that note, but a lot to be aware of and keep our eyes on. Thank you, as always, for your great analysis and just all the work you've been doing over these many years. Thanks again.
Thank you, Pia. Great to be with you.
David Sanger's new book is called New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. You're listening to The Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio, Sirius XM 169, as well as on the CBC Listen app. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. So Canada is getting old. At least our population is. One in five Canadians is over the age of 65. And yet, when we talk about aging, it often amounts to an awkward conversation between grown children and their parents. And it's a conversation many of us avoid, or at least want to avoid. Laura Tamblyn-Watts is the CEO of Canada's National Seniors Advocacy Group, CanAge. Laura's also spent the last 25 years as a lawyer working on the rights of older people in our country. She has a new book out. It is called Let's Talk About Aging Parents. Laura, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's begin with your story. Just by way of background, I will tell you that my parents, I'm lucky enough to have them around still. My dad just turned 84 last week. My mom, 82. And these are the conversations, I guess, that we're supposed to have more readily, but we don't. So thank you for your book. But let me ask you about your story. How have you handled the situation with your own aging parents? How did you handle it? What was it like for you to talk about the future with them?
A dance, like I think it is for so many people. I talk about these conversations as being an art, not a science, because I don't know about you, but I go into my house and all of a sudden I'm 16 years old, and not 52, and my parents are still my parents, no matter if they're 87 or whatever whatever age they are at that time. And that's also been the experience of so many other people. I am also a daughter-in-law to two sets of older adults as well. And so I think, like many people, I got lots of people in my life, and navigating those conversations is a challenge.
So broadly, why is this so hard of a conversation for us to have? You know, we tend to live in a society that is much more open about talking about things that were once taboo, but we still really struggle with this one.
I think it's this combination of all the things that we don't like together. The first is so many families, mine included, there's a couple things you don't talk about. You don't talk about money, you don't talk about health, and you don't talk about death. So those are three of the most important things that we talk about. You also don't talk about how we need to plan for the future if things go wrong. Kind of feels like wishing something ill on someone. Of course, it's not the case. Layering that in with this sense of ageism, and people, of course, are wrapped up in their own family norms and relationships. It comes together as a bit of the perfect storm for not moving forward. And again, no one has been trained or necessarily has the prompts for how to come at these conversations or do something about it that doesn't end up with being, you know, thrown out the door and not invited for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, anecdotally, one person, either the child or the parent, are ready to have this conversation, and they go into it thinking, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And then the reaction is the other person isn't ready to do that dance that night or that day, right? They get upset, or they're like, you're putting me in the grave, or why are you talking about you dying? It's freaking me out. Like, you know, all those things. So both partners have to be ready to dance at the same time, don't they?
They really do. And this is especially true when we're full of anxieties about things, right? Because underneath those conversations are worries. There's worries about mom with hip frailty living on her own at 92 in that three-floor walk-up when you know she's falling, but she's not telling you she's falling. We're worried about dad who doesn't have a diagnosis of dementia, but kind of isn't really tracking anymore. We're worried that we live across the country or we're not living up to cultural norms. We're worried what it's going to cost, and we don't really have those answers.
We'll talk about some of those in a moment, but kind of use the image of, you know, two people looking at the same object, but can have different perspectives about it. So when you mention that if you're the kid, you might be worried about dad falling down the stairs or mom breaking a hip or whatever, but they might hear that as a conversation that you're having with them about them not being independent and not being able to live the life that they want to live.
When you're looking at things from different perspectives, it's important to remember that these are emotionally charged as well. And so what I ask people to do is take a step back. Remember it was when your mother said, I liked your hair so well before, when, you know, you had it off your face and you got so angry, because really what she's trying to say is a compliment, and what you're taking at it is, you know, you hate my hair and you always criticize me and remember that time where you really embarrassed me, and you have all this unpacking family history. Same thing. And so adding to that, you also have this notion of role reversal, which I really reject. We don't reverse roles. We don't become the parents to our aging children. No, it's actually those structured roles, and they're going to kind of expect that you, no matter how old you walk in, you're going to be 16, and that they're expecting that you're going to ask them for advice and ask them for what to do. And I recommend using that as a strategy. So instead of putting them on their back foot saying, hey, mom, do you really think you can live here? I don't know. Those stairs are pretty steep. Where she's going to hear, I need you to move out. You think I'm old and incapable and frail. You could approach it a different way by saying, look, I'm really thinking I might downsize. I hurt my knee last year and I'm trying to figure out what to do. I'd love your opinions on what to do about that. What are you thinking? And all of a sudden, now we can have a conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, listening to you, because this is really about how people perceive what power they have in a conversation, right? And who's driving that conversation. I think the other part of it, though, Laura, is also, again, anecdotally, and I think that a lot of people feel this way, is this sort of internal struggle. And you have spoken about this caregiver burden, as you call it, which comes with taking care of loved ones. No one wants to admit that providing care for an aging parent, having to take care of them, having to have them move into your basement or your house or whatever, is a burden. But in reality, if we take away the loaded idea of the word burden, it is, isn't it? What do you mean by the caregiver burden?
It's exhausting. It's important to remember things can be burdens and joy at the same time. Anyone who's had a newborn may remember 3 a.m. where you think to yourself, I used to love you at 2 o'clock, and at 3 o'clock, I'm exhausted and would do anything to make you go to bed. It doesn't mean that it's not a wonderful thing. It doesn't even mean it's not an obligation, but it has strain. In fact, one of the things that we see as we're moving from a sandwich generation to what I call a club sandwich generation is that we have about 6 generations going now. So I've been supporting people in their mid-90s who are taking care of their 72-year-old children who have dementia, who are also having kids in their late 40s, who have kids in their mid-20s, who have grandchildren. And that's the first time we've ever had that many generations going at one time. I wrote this book for people, 30 to 75, because that's the age where caregiving burden really hits. So you may be raising your children, your grandchildren, or taking care of your mother or your grandmother. It's exhausting. So these are some of the strategies to make things a little less hard and to help you understand what do things cost and what don't they cost and how can you plan for it now?
Okay, let's talk about some practicality. So as you know, I'm up at 3 a.m. thinking my parents, thankfully, again, are in good health now. But, you know, I'm thinking about the future and what ifs. So what are the costs like across our country for providing in-home care for seniors?
Buckle up, sit down and take a breath for what I'm about to tell you. At the very low end, this is as cheap as I've ever seen it, about $100,000 for live-in care for a healthcare aide or a PSW, not a nurse, just someone who's got some training, but $100,000 is the low end. Urban centers, $300,000.
Over what period, Laura?
If you get a 24-hour care, that's what it's going to cost. And many people, you know, think to themselves, oh, I'm just going to have someone move in. I'll get 24-hour care. The reality is you'll probably get a little bit of home care a few hours a week from the public home care providers. If you're in some places, and Ontario is a good example, even if you qualify for home care, there could be a waiting list in Ontario right now. As one example, 6,000 people have been approved for home care for publicly funded supports. And there are no people to do it. And that's not even thinking about the waiting list for other things like long-term care. So coming together with strategies around who do you have in your community or your broader network is going to be really important. And then figuring out, okay, if we're going to be bringing in care, what will be covered and what are we going to have to make up one way or the other?
And just to clarify, when you say these whopper numbers, $100,000 to $300,000, you mean per year?
Annually.
Oh, wow. Okay. Whew.
I told you to sit down.
Are there ways that people who are younger can start thinking about ways to mitigate these costs, either for themselves or for their parents as they age?
Yes. Look, there's some practical things you can do about aging in place. You can do simple, easy things. Go out to the store and buy double banisters, not single ones. You'll reduce your risk of falling by 56%. If you fall and break a hip, your chances of dying are about 25% in the first year, 40% in the next year. If I'm thinking about trying to create powers of attorney, wills, having conversations about what ifs, and of course, driving, all of those things we can do for us no matter what our age. It's good to have a plan.
And in our country, which is very diverse, different cultures have different ways of approaching care for people who are aging. I know in my household, this is a sore point sometimes in the conversations when we're having that, like, you know, back in India, they don't do this to old people. And I retort, well, Mom, you're in Canada, you know, like this is kind of, and we get into it. But have you seen these cultural differences play out in families that are struggling to come up with solutions for their aging ones? And how, I need help. How do I do this without being at least coming across as insulting?
The joy of our country is our diversity. The joy of these conversations is also that you have to have diverse conversations based on what your cultural norms and expectations are. And face is part of it as well. Sometimes they may not actually want the thing that's in the old country, but they want to be able to have a narrative around it when they go to church, temple, or wherever it is that they're gathering together. And so I think it's important to start the conversation from sideways. Ask a little bit about who people in your circle, what are they doing? How is, you know, Auntie so-and-so, or how is your friend such-and-such? What are they doing? Oh, well, you know, their daughter lives in a 400 square foot apartment in Toronto. You know, she would love to be with her, but it's not practical, but they did this. Oh, how do you feel about that? Right? So start to kind of talk about other people. That's usually a good conversation point. Hear the pain points. So, oh, it was so embarrassing for her to see that people were really offended that she wasn't able to move in because, you know, the daughter-in-law who's, you know, not from that same culture was like, no way, it's the marriage or your mom, right? And get those narratives together, whatever the cultural norms are. Then wait. Don't put them all at the same time. This is important. These things and stages are important. The next time, have a sense of what your visits are like. Does she want to come and stay with you? How does that go? What have we learned from visiting for a week, 2 weeks, a month? Put those pieces into place. Is there an opportunity for lane housing? Is there an opportunity to have an apartment next door? Or are they worried about loneliness? And actually what should happen is two of her girlfriends should move into that big rambling house with her. And that would meet the norms and the needs and that you come every so often. So listen, talk about people in your neighborhood or their aunties and friends, and then figure out how does it feel when you vacation. Then put together a strategy.
If you're just joining me on this Sunday morning, I'm speaking with CanAge CEO, Laura Tamblyn Watts. Laura has a new book out. It's an important one. It's called Let's Talk About Aging Parents. Okay, Laura, so you and I have been talking about the kind of the micro things, like the individual approach to this. I want to pull out and be a bit macro about this. Canada has an aging population. Over the next 20 years, our population of people ages 65 and older expected to grow by about 68%, according to Statistics Canada. You work in the field of law and aging. You've been doing this for a quarter of a century. So here is, I don't know, it's kind of a basic question. Is Canada adequately prepared to deal with our aging population?
I wonder how loudly I can say no to that answer. We are so not prepared. Okay, first of all, we are the only country in the OECD, so the comparator of 20 other countries that are most like us, that doesn't even have a national senior strategy. We don't have a really good plan for basic things like long-term care. I was part of the group that put together some national standards, which are an idea and not in place. We have this fractured provincial federal system. We have an incredible shortage of healthcare providers who are themselves aging, or if they come into aged care, the average churn time where they come in and then decide to leave is about 18 months to 2 years. And that's just within the medical system. When we're thinking about how we build houses, we're not building them in a way that makes them age inclusive or accessible. Transit, if you're outside of any major urban center, transit is often just either non-existent or not a real possibility for people. And all of that wraps up to say, our country's got to get serious about this. And we're so far behind that the narrative I keep hearing from boomers, oh, it'll all be different when I'm old. And then I say, really? When's that going to be? Because because our boomers by 2030 will start turning 85. Gen Xers like me at 2030 will start turning 65. And let's not forget our millennials, the biggest group we've ever had, bigger than the boomers. By 2030, they start turning 50. So no, the time was 20 years ago, but at least let's do it now. And this book hopefully will help us stay out of those acute care systems. We'll stay out of those places where we don't want to be and preserve our resources for where we really need them.
And of course, though, government does have a role to play. And I'll ask you about the federal government and the budget in just a moment. But when you look across our country, like maybe the governments aren't doing enough, but is there a province or a policy that you look to say, yeah, like we should all adopt that one or we should follow that lead?
So this is the optimistic part. There's patchwork, great stuff all across the country. It's just, it's not consistent across the country. And a patchwork means that there's inequities. If you're on one side of a river in Ottawa or the other side of the river in Gatineau with totally different systems. I would say Quebec is really good for social care and they have a better home care system and integrated community-based social service system than just about anywhere. BC did a really good job about 20 years ago, but bringing the unions together, they did a big payout. And so actually employees in our health and social care systems make more in BC than anywhere in the country, and they have better services. That means their churn is less, and frankly, they're able to retain. They're also doing a really good job around promoting specific immigration and training. They also do the best, probably, stuff on elder abuse and neglect in the country. We have entire jurisdictions with nothing on elder abuse and neglect, and it's about 1 in 6 older people right now. So lots of good initiatives, but there's no consistency.
Okay, and then let's talk about the federal government. It tabled its budget, of course, this past Tuesday. Interestingly, as it pertains to our conversation, the budget itself was titled Fairness for Every Generation, and it includes giving more money to provinces earmarked for improving long-term care standards and following up on earlier promises to increase old age security and the guaranteed income supplement. In terms of the federal government's approach at this point, how do you assess those policies that were announced this past Tuesday?
So when I went through the budget analysis, I did put a red circle around every generation and then put a big question mark beside it, because this is a very youth-focused budget. And what I don't want is this idea of generations banging up against each other. The whole book and our whole philosophy is that generations need to work together. But this is a youth-focused budget. There's actually very little in here for older people. The way that we even calculate CPP, OAS, GIS, what we call the market-based measure and the consumer price index, is so outdated. It's based on generations before home care or prescriptions or things that older adults need are not even in the calculation. And so it's the very way that we cost things out is so inaccurate for older people that they are kind of doubly in trouble. And so we have this hidden poverty amongst older adults because we calculate things in the wrong way. When I look at what was good, there's a start to the beginning of a commitment to start. That's exactly how thin it is. A conversation about creating a national caregiving strategy across all generations. That's good. But when there's little practical measures that they can do, here's what I would say. The Minister for Health and the Minister for Seniors, Mark Holman and Seamus O'Regan, have really moved forward as hard as they can in bringing national standards to the table, but they can't force provinces to take them. And they have tried to push funding in that direction. But they haven't taken important steps in the financial space that would really help older people yet.
Okay, you know, you mentioned this budget being for young people, and then we're talking about the other side of the spectrum, older people, and just taking it out of the realm of governments and back into sort of, you know, the cultural lens of all of this, the societal lens. You hear it all the time from people who are aging. You know, technology, I feel really left behind in the world. It's hard. Why do we have to do all these things? And I get that this is probably true historically, that as you get old, you feel a little left out of the changing, evolving societal picture. But there is that word that you brought up earlier in our conversation, ageism. It's not just in Canada, it's around the world, and especially in Western societies as we have an aging population. How harmful is ageism? Sometimes people think, you know, it's kind of just a joke.
It's such a joke in our minds that you, in fact, can see it as plain as you can imagine by going into any place that you buy your greeting cards. Go to anything that starts with a zero. Statistically, for women, it should be 40. For men, it's more like 50 or 60. So you see that ageism is also gendered. Open up a birthday card and see what it says inside. It's going to be horrible. And then imagine, if you will, any other form of discrimination. Imagine that CARB was making fun of people of color, people of different genders or sexual orientations, people with differing abilities or accessibility needs. And then you realize that ageism is the last socially acceptable form of discrimination. The World Health Organization a few years ago did a global study and found that 50% of the world's population was profoundly ageist. We thought, oh, we're Canadian. We're nicer than that. SatScan did one. We're worse. 56% of Canadians are profoundly ageist. And that means that we are internalizing that discrimination and then any other kinds of marginalization on top of it.
Okay, Laura, I know a lot of people listening to us right now are saying, okay, I'm going to do it. Like, today's the day. I'm going to call mom. I'm going to book lunch with dad next week, but I'm scared. Oh my gosh, what if they get angry for this present that I think is a nice present and they're going to say, how dare you? So we just need to take a first step, a lot of us. So what is that first step?
Wow. Self-interestedly, I'd say probably buy the book, but only in the sense that then you're working off of the same song sheet. Again, part of that idea is saying, you know, I'm thinking about my own aging. Use something in your own life or a friend as opposed to attacking it about your parent dead on. That can really help. But what I would say first is go through a series of what ifs. Imagine someone was in an accident, a car accident, fell down the stairs, and think about it as if there's a critical incident that could happen to somebody at any age. And then use that as a conversational prompt and try to figure out what people want. And then try to figure out how can we support those wants so they don't feel pushed.
Listen when you're talking. Also, listen to the other person, right?
Listen to understand. Don't listen to answer.
This is an extraordinarily important topic for us to be talking about. I appreciate it so much. And for helping us all, you know, start these conversations by giving us some guidance. Appreciate you so much, Laura. Thank you.
Thanks, Bea.
Laura Tamblyn-Watts is the CEO of Canada's National Seniors Advocacy Group, CanAge, and she has a new book. It is called Let's Talk About Aging Parents. I know a lot of you can relate to this. So how have you navigated these kinds of conversations, whether you're an adult kid with an older parent or that parent? Send us your stories, advice, breakthroughs, and bombs. Our email address is sunday@cbc.ca.
The climate is changing, so are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore Indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
On April 7th, 1994, soldiers taking part in the United Nations assistance mission for Rwanda woke up to a morning of indiscriminate bloodshed. The Rwandan president's plane had been shot down hours earlier, ending a fragile peace deal between the country's Hutu and Tutsi populations. Over the next 3 months, more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed. It was one of the worst genocides of the 21st century. Throughout the massacre, the head of that UN task force begged world leaders to pay attention to the slaughter and do something, anything, to end it. But Romeo Dallaire's pleas were not listened to. 30 years later, the retired Canadian Lieutenant General is still living with the trauma of what he witnessed. And although Rwanda has mostly recovered from the genocide, he says the world has not learned the lessons from what happened. Romeo Dallaire's new book is called The Peace, A Warrior's Journey. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning.
I want to start by asking about that fatal morning 30 years ago, April 7th, 1994. When you go back to that day, what do you think about?
I think of the particular madness, if not close to rage, that we had warned the international community, we had warned the UN, we had told them that this thing would go catastrophic and that we needed resources to try to prevent this from happening. And that nobody came, nobody answered, and the thing was blowing up in our face.
And as you say, there were many warning signs before those killings began. You tried to intervene, and you didn't try to intervene even once or twice. It was repeated and repeated and then some. What happened each time you tried to step in and do something or ask people to do something?
Well, the first thing they would tell me is they'd say, no, this is outside of the mandate that the UN had given me. So they said, you cannot use force. And I didn't have much anyways. But still, you cannot intervene in processes that are going on. You're there only to assist. So I kept getting, you're not allowed to do that. But worse is that the countries who lend the troops to the UN, they're the ones who put the restrictions on their troops. And so their troops were not allowed by their own countries to intervene. So you get this stopping of the process of trying to take the forces that you have and applying them to the problem, because not only the UN is saying it's out of your mandate, but the countries who lent the troops to the UN are also saying that they didn't send them there for that.
You refused an order from your superiors to leave Rwanda as the genocide was then ramping up. 2,000 of your troops obeyed. They fled. As a former military man, but you're born and bred a military guy, that must have been a difficult calculation. And maybe I'm speaking as a layperson here, but like, when is it okay for a commander to disobey orders?
Yeah, that's interesting. Countries started by the Belgians started pulling their troops out on their own. They just left. Without even the authority of the UN, because the troops still belong to the country. So over 2,100, in fact, left. And then with only about 400 left, I had still asked for reinforcements. And instead of getting that, I get the order from the Secretary General himself to pull out and abandon the 32,000 about ones that we had under our protection, even with my small force. And so you face the scenario of a legal order from your senior officer saying that you are to pull out because your mandate is not there anymore, your troops are at risk. And then you have a moral side to this that says, if I pull out, those 32,000 are going to get slaughtered just like the other ones. And so I'm in a ethical, moral dilemma. And so the response, even for a commander, has got to be instinctively reactive to the situation. And so I didn't even debate it. It just came out, no, I'm not leaving. I'm not abandoning. The moral dimension overrode the legal dimension. So I didn't give a damn if they're going to court-martial me. I didn't want to sit with 32,000 people that I left to be slaughtered.
You lay out much of your experience in your book, Shake Hands with the Devil. It's been 2 decades since that book came out. What made you want to revisit the atrocities and the trauma of the genocide now?
It never really left me. In fact, as I say, often my soul is still running in the hills of Rwanda. Shake Hands with the Devil was a commander's perspective of what had happened. I then wrote a book, They Fight Like Children and They Die Like Children, to describe how the tactical problems of soldiers facing child soldiers in a scenario like the Rwandan genocide, because most of the killing was done by a youth movement that had been indoctrinated and turned into a militia. And then the third book was living with 20 years of PTSD, but was not clear at the time, but has become since with our more research, is that it wasn't just a PTSD sort of punctual shock type of injury that I had sustained. It was a moral injury, because I was taking decisions that were morally so abhorrent to our normal way of life that I was seeing things happening that were so perverse to all the values that we had, that profound injury kept me on ultimately 25 years of therapy and still 9 pills a day today. And so the book I'm writing now is moving from this scenario of trying to sort out a problem to one of prevention and ultimately looking at a lasting peace versus all these damn truces that we seem to be looking for.
We'll talk more about the conflicts we see in the world currently in just a bit, but I want to go back to your PTSD. And I'm sorry that you suffered that and continue to have to deal with that all these years later. How are you doing?
I, about not quite 7 years ago, I had just left the Senate. I was working full time with my institute at Dalhousie on children, peace and security and preventing their recruitment. At the time, the doctors said the way of life that I was leading, they said, you don't have 2 years to live, because I was subtly working myself to kill myself. And then I discovered this extraordinary woman who had been involved very much in soldiers being injured and families and so on. And I fell in love. And that is what broke the code. Now I want to live another 25 years. Now I want to live in love into eternity. Because love, I discovered through her. And previous to that, it was good arrangements and so on, and we worked things out. But when I fell in love, and I've subsequently married this wonderful woman, that has given me the desire to continue to pursue and overcome the injury that remains and try to cover the scars that I still have to live with.
Congratulations on your marriage. I know, as you just said there, and you write about, it was life-changing for you.
If there's no love, there cannot be even a spiritual sense of well-being. And I don't mean spiritual in a sense of religious. I mean spiritual, your inner being is simply not going to achieve its full potential, because it will always be looking over its shoulder. And you end up sometimes in a mode of survival instead of continuing to thrive.
If you're just joining us, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with retired Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire. He has a new book out. It is called The Peace, A Warrior's Journey. You mentioned some of the conflicts we're seeing in the world. The title of your new book is called The Peace, and it certainly feels like the world is becoming less and less peaceful. So what do you want world leaders to take away from the experience of Rwanda to apply to conflicts that are raging right now?
Well, the first thing is we've discovered that they've done nothing to learn from the lessons that we have worked on for the last 30 years. And we did a lot of work on establishing the international tribunal, on a concept for the whole world on responsibility to protect, that where people are being abused massively, we go in and protect people. There's just no political will to want to take the risks of trying to protect civilians and apply the human rights principles and prevent mass atrocities as we are seeing. And there is also an unwillingness to engage to prevent conflicts from happening. On the contrary, we're more prepared to throw ammunition and give resources to people who want to fight than actually being engaged to intervene and to stop fighting. So all that reflects an era of lack of statesmanship, of lack of political will, of risk-taking, of humility, and a desire to advance humanity. So when I was originally working on my book, I wanted it to be focused on prevention of conflict, only to realize that all the stuff we've been doing over these years, even after World War II, remember World War II ends, oh, we got peace. No, we didn't, because the next day we started off with the Warsaw Pact and the Soviets and ended up in a Cold War. So all these truces have found no strength in sustaining peace. I'm arguing that we can move beyond these truces, that we can, in fact, establish lasting peace. And the ones that are going to do it are those who are going to revolutionize the institutions that we're in. Because All the institutions we live with now have been created by men. It's male dominated, it's paternalistic, it's even misogynist, and it has prevented the extraordinary input that women as equals could bring into the leadership philosophies, into the institutional philosophies that would bring the full complement of humanity into solving some of these situations and move us to a plane of a much higher perspective of not looking to solve the immediate, but in fact looking to establish lasting peace. And in so doing, create the solidarity of humanity. That's the first revolution. The women are going to crack the code because the guys will not pull it off.
You mentioned, you know, so many wars end in truces now, or at least hold at truces. And we see that conversation happening now. There are people who are pushing for truces in various conflicts around the world. If not a truce, what to do?
The first thing to do is work to prevent these damn frictions from exploding into the catastrophic failures that we have. And so, I mean, that Russia invaded Ukraine, was that really a surprise, or was that us showing our hubris in bringing in all the old Warsaw Pact countries into NATO and squeezing Russia, and Russia finding itself in a situation of having to respond in a sense of insecurity? And then we have this age-old sort of frictions that were there, which was a great excuse to go after the Ukrainians. And so you didn't work at a strategic statesman level of trying to resolve and prevent conflicts from happening. You're reacting to these things. You're reacting in a way that ultimately creates catastrophic failure because you don't seem to be able to find victory even in your reaction. What you end up with is some sort of an arrangement that might hopefully stop the killing, stop the shooting, and there's some line there that's established, and people try to get on with life, and hopefully that it won't happen again. Well, we have, I've been on an international commission on the principles of peace, and over the last 20 years, not one of the peace agreements that have been signed have lasted more than 7 years. They've all essentially been truces. Why? Because, yeah, the elites get their sort of payback and they stabilize and so on. But there's no fundamental desire to go right into the entrails of the problem, down to the communities and down to the cultural frameworks, down to religious differences, the economic differences, and try to find ways to ease the rage that exists on those who are disenfranchised and stop the gross greed in the world to abuse power and to think that by having power, you will actually build peace. No, you will not build peace. You'll build truces, because only when you have human security, which is the whole spectrum of what humanity is, will you actually be able to establish an atmosphere of peace that can be lasting, that can be building on respect and dignity, and ultimately move us all into a focused solution of how humanity can thrive on this planet and beyond.
To the points that you're making there, you recently said that you find that the international community is even more guilty today than it was some 30 years ago for its inability to find leadership and courage to intervene, prevent, or participate in conflict. I think for people that remember what happened in Rwanda, to say it's worse now, I just want you to help us understand that.
We saw an outright genocide being played out, and that's after the killing fields of Cambodia on top of that. And we saw even in Europe and Yugoslavia how we were able to slaughter each other for differences that go back, you know, 450 years. We spent years in this sort of period of post-Cold War peace dividend time frame of looking at this and studying what instruments can be built. And there were some changes in the UN that were very tactical. The International Tribunal come in. There's the R2P that came in. But what didn't happen is two things. One, the major powers, China, Russia, the United States, rearmed during that time frame as Europe disarmed and was looking for solutions of peace. And that's why the European Union it was created. I mean, they've been at each other's throat for how many millennia, and they've established a peace. The second side of that is the political elites of the world. Political they are, which is fine. We need politicians to run our democracies, and it's a noble calling, have not been able to rise above the fact that they are so concentrated on near-term self-interest and the avoidance of risks because they want to save their own skin, forgetting totally that frictions that lead to wars and conflicts, be they in the Congo, be they in Syria, be they in Myanmar, be they in Colombia, will have an impact on us. These refugee camps will establish and create pandemics. The rage in those camps and so on will create more generational wars. The use of children as instruments of war will guarantee that all they know is what to fight and banditry and so on. And the diasporas are going to continue to get torn between the what's going on back home, the original home, and how to establish themselves in their new countries. So we find an era in which the best that can happen is that the politicians may bring a solution with old tools, old diplomatic think, old male-dominated sort of hubris type of constructs to find a temporary solution and get on with other things. While, in fact, all they're doing is putting a veneer on that at the cost of millions of people being displaced, murdered, slaughtered, and suffering. So we got to cut loose with that type of philosophy. And that's why I also say in my book, to establish real peace, yeah, it might take a couple centuries. But the revolutions of the women engaged and influencing and changing the nature of much of our institutions and making them far more integrated, and the youth who are able to use the technology to keep the whole world engaged, I believe that, yeah, a couple centuries will pull this off. And hey, what's a couple centuries? We've been slaughtering each other for 10,000 years. We can handle that.
Let's talk about our country. You have also said that you're disappointed in Canada's engagement in the world. We're a middle power. What do you see as the problem here?
There's been an introversion of this country. There's been a near deliberate assault on our diplomatic corps. Take away the initiative, the intellect, the use of us being a leading middle power in the world to be able to influence and bring a bridge between those who are in still developing stages and the evolutionary stages and the big boys who are still stomping around and using power as their premise for security. And Canada was a very powerful bridge. It's turned inside itself. We have lost our influence. I'm hearing where I go now because of my work with child soldiers around the world, and you say Canada, and they say, oh, yes, yes. In French, we use the term grand parleur, petit faisant. You know, big talker, but little doer. And so we have sort of fallen on the coattails of the big players and fiddled. And so, yeah, we're into Europe now and NATO and trying to form a line that we hope will never be crossed in Latvia and so on. Yeah, we're engaged in discussions diplomatically in the UN and on the ground a bit in Gaza. We've done very little in Myanmar and so on. We are not seen as an innovative, extraordinarily insightful and resilient nation that wants a role of leadership in the world because it feels it has that role.
So if our country wanted to get to the place where you say it should get, how should it go about doing that?
The first element of that is to rebuild fundamentally our diplomatic core and our philosophy of Canada in the world. Not Canada inside Canada only. And until we see that Canada is a nation of extraordinary potential, that we, through sweat and tears and blood, built this extraordinary country with a potential that is unequaled around the world, in not only resource-based, but in its intellectual capability and its desire and its values and its sense of purpose, that until we see that that potential has got to be put also in front of humanity to build humanity and to advance humanity, we will stay small.
In your book, you make many references to Dante's famous poem, Inferno, and you wrote,
yes.
You write that the poem almost literally conveys the arc of your own life's journey. How so?
I've been through hell. I have fiddled with the warrior ethic and the concepts that we have of security and peace and stability, lived the purgatory of continuously falling back into the same rut of problems, but seeing the situation not necessarily getting better in a global sense, but having punctual successes that sometimes are very ephemeral. But then I broke through the code and said, no, there's something far, far stronger that humanity can move towards. And we've got to go through this burning arc that, in fact, Dante does, in order to move into paradise, where he realizes that, hey, paradise is not just milk and honey. You got to work at paradise. You got to work to ultimately go beyond yourself. Dante, he was looking for God. What I'm looking for is humanity going and absorbing the universe to the full potential that we can.
Romeo Dallaire, you and I have spoken many times over the past 20 years or so, and I'm so happy to be able to listen to you today and see that you found some inner peace and happiness. I'm really happy for you.
Oh, very kind of you. This is very, very nice. And I'm not a Pollyanna. I truly believe that the revolutions of women and the youth are going to break the code to move us beyond truces, beyond purgatory, into lasting peace.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Take care.
Romeo Dallaire's new book is called The Peace, A Warrior's Journey. You're listening to The Sunday Magazine. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. The world's biggest election is now underway in India. With 969 million eligible voters, it is a colossal democratic process that will be staggered over the course of 6 weeks. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his party is seeking a third term. And while it seems unlikely there will be anything but a decisive Modi victory, analysts are watching for how the Prime Minister will continue carving out his cultural and political vision for his country and what the implications are for the rest of the world. Ravi Agrawal is the editor-in-chief of the global affairs magazine Foreign Policy. He is also CNN's former New Delhi bureau chief and the author of India Connected. Ravi, good morning.
Good morning.
So there are nearly a billion eligible voters across India, a vast country, some 28 states, different languages, different geography. So even holding an election itself is a feat. Add to that, there's this law that states voters can't be required to travel more than 2 kilometers from their home to get to a polling station. So with all of that, just describe the efforts of getting an election of this size and scale and scope underway.
Yeah, I mean, Indian elections at any time are always just this huge, spectacular undertaking. As you pointed out, you know, almost a billion people are eligible to vote. In the last Indian election, about 67% of the eligible voters voted. So if any of that is replicated this time round, you're looking at around about 600 million people potentially actually casting their votes. And India does pride itself on making every possible effort to make sure that everyone does get a chance to vote. And so this means an election that is spread over the course of 44 days, held in several phases to ensure that the focus can be on various areas or regions at different times. And the parts of India that have polling booths include, you know, Himalayan regions. So this is not the, just the length and breadth of India, but also the height of India in some senses. And, you know, the Election Commission really does try very hard to make sure that they reach voters where they are because of the rule you just mentioned.
Okay, so this election is being described as the world's biggest democratic project. We often hear that term when Indians go to the polls. But when you look at the political environment inside the country today, would you agree with that description?
I think what you're referring to here is a general understanding that some of the pillars of democracy have been weakened in the last decade or so. And there are various rankings that show some of this to be the case, whether it is Freedom House, which ranks India as just partly free in its rankings of democracies around the world, whether it is Reporters Without Borders, which ranks India 161st in the world out of 180 countries for freedom of the press, whether it's the judiciary, whose independence has also been eroded, that leads some to question just how democratic India is if some of the key pillars of democracy are being eroded. Now, all of that said, it depends on how you define democracy in a literal sense, in terms of India being an electoral democracy. It is an electoral democracy. It holds elections that are largely free and fair. The BJP, which is the party of Narendra Modi, India's two-time prime minister, loses state elections from time to time. So Indians, for example, will point out that their elections are free and fair, and they deserve to be for their country to be known as the world's largest democracy.
So as we talk about a healthy democracy, one pillar of that is press freedom. It is integral all the time, but especially during an election campaign. So how would you describe the ability of Indian voters to get factual information about the government and about the parties as they head to the polls?
That is a bit challenged. I think India's media ecosystem has become less free and fair over the last 15 or so years. And I say this as someone who has worked in India as a journalist. So I've seen that erosion firsthand. And I say it as someone who now, sitting in the United States of America as an editor, covers and watches India from afar. There are several reasons for this. There are several major newspapers and media companies and TV channels that have recently been bought by business families that are seen and perceived to be by many as close to the ruling party. There is generally acknowledged to be a climate of a chilling effect of sorts where domestic media does not feel as emboldened and empowered as it used to be able to challenge policies of the government. There isn't as much of a vibrant debate as there used to be in terms of policy. And then if you look more directly at India's prime minister himself, he is the only Indian prime minister in history who has not allowed reporters to question him in an open press conference. He only rarely sits down for interviews. When he does, those interviews tend to be with publications or interviewers who do not ask him very tough questions. India, for example, executes more internet shutdowns than any other country in the world. This is when the state is able to basically switch off the internet. Think of it as a kill switch of sorts, in which no one in a particular radius is able to access the internet. And it sometimes does this to prevent people from being able to, you know, report on a certain incident. Sometimes it is to not spread panic, but it's a very draconian response to the potential of spreading panic. And again, it goes hand in hand with some of the criticisms of India being less democratic and less free than it should be.
Prime Minister Modi is the envy of every potential or wannabe politician in the world, in the sense that his approval ratings are astronomical. You know, hovering around 80% in some polls. He may be the world's most popular leader. But as you said, he's a man who rarely gives you media interviews, doesn't hold press conferences, doesn't participate in many parliamentary debates. How do you explain why he's so popular amongst Indians today?
There are many reasons for this. Before I even talk about him, I think many Indians will say that he is often their best option because there aren't very many great alternatives. So I think before you even begin to get into why people express their approval of someone's leadership, and in Modi's case, the most recent ratings from Pew Research Center show that about 78% of Indians at large approve of his leadership. So some of that also has to do with a sort of a reflection on the options available to them. But on Modi specifically, he is a charismatic leader, it is fair to say. He is a masterful orator in Hindi. He is widely perceived as very hardworking and committed to the country's success. He does not have a partner. He does not have children. And in a very Indian sense, it is seen and perceived that because he doesn't have a partner, in a sense, he is devoted to the country, so his country is his life, and B, he has no reason to turn to nepotism or corruption because he would have no one to give any wealth to. These are not my opinions. These are perceptions that I'm pointing to that most Indians or vast majority of Indians will point to. Modi has also done very well to maximize his opportunity to use foreign policy in a domestic sense. So Indians, for example, by large, this is a generalization, but they love to see their country as riding high on the world stage. And this, of course, comes from, you know, a history of that not being the case during the colonial era. So when Modi hosts the G20 summit, for example, which he did last year, he has been very canny at being able to market that domestically. Last year, his posters were just sort of plastered all over the country in billboards. You know, and hosting the G20 is a very perfunctory thing. A different country hosts it every year. It should not be exceptional. Modi made it exceptional in India because he is so good at marketing himself. Modi is a leader whose PR machinery is perhaps better than any other leaders in the world. And what is politics ultimately? Part of politics is the ability to tell a story, to spin a narrative, to market yourself. Modi has also been able to just make Indians, especially Hindus, proud of who they are, proud of their culture, proud of their religion. So those are some of the many reasons why he tends to be so popular among Indians. Now, this is not to say that there aren't problems in his leadership. There are many of those, and we can get into them. But by and large, when you look at supply and demand, Modi's won the last two elections, and polls suggest he's very likely to win this one too.
Yeah, so let's talk about the problems and the perception, because as you say, he projects his stuff. There are lots of criticisms of Modi from within India, but mostly from without, from the outside world, of his authoritarian nature, about cracking down on Muslims who are by number a large part of the Indian population. So talk to me about those challenges.
Oh, there are many challenges. I think the most important one is actually one you didn't mention, which is unemployment. India has a real unemployment problem that, by the way, predates Modi. I think India just has so many young people. This is a youth unemployment rate of around about 15 or 16%, which if you look at the raw numbers, half of all Indians are under the age of 25, for example. This is a major demographic challenge that Modi is going to encounter. Women, for example, are chronically underemployed. There's been a decline in foreign direct investment over the last few years. There's been a decline in domestic investment in the economy as well, as some business houses are worried about, you know, the prospects for India's economy. Then on the social side, the stuff you did mention, I mean, Modi is broadly seen quite rightly as pro-Hindu, as mobilizing the Hindu vote. 80% of the country is Hindu, which is almost a billion people. 14% of the population is Muslim, which is about 200 million, the largest minority in the world, and the third biggest population of Muslims in the world. Modi has marginalized them through legislation, but also through public discourse, through dog whistles from prominent people in his party. Those are all things that trouble civil society leaders who worry about the secular nature of India being challenged by a party that has long had a vision of India as a Hindu nation.
Modi, you know, critics lump him in with into an international coalition of populist top-down authoritarian leaders, people like Viktor Orban. There are others, of course. But you, in writing about these elections, say that the BJP, that's Modi's party's positions, are in part driven by demand, that his stance and policies are quite popular to the public in that way. Flesh that out for me a little bit more, that demand side of things.
It is very easy to see leaders and strongmen like Narendra Modi as purely a top-down phenomenon, in that you have a powerful, driven leader who has a vision for the way things need to be, and they push that vision and use the instruments of the state and their own will to bend the nation's will to theirs. And, you know, that's a popular way of looking at things because it's an easy way to look at things. I mean, it explains the word strongman. And that is true. And that's the supply side of the equation. And we must grapple with the supply side of the equation. I think we must also grapple with the demand side of the equation. I say this all the time about any story in any country. But in India's case, I think it's important to examine it because no country is static. No people are static. India's people may have wanted something else 75 years ago when, by and large, there was an agreement that at India's founding in 1947, for it to survive, for it to unite, it needed to be secular. It needed to have a vision to knit together different groups, different states, different communities together. That notion could change. I'm not saying it should. Frankly, I don't want it to. But it could be changing because it could be that with as many young people as India has, and as I said, half of this country's population is under the age of 25, it could be that they want something else. It could be that they look at this vision of a Hindu-first nation, of a country that prioritizes one religion over others, of a country that is less liberal, and I mean liberal in a classic Western sense of prioritizing individual rights. Maybe they look at those things and say, well, we want to do it our way. We want to figure out an Indian, indigenous way of thinking about these issues and problems. And we want to rethink the very foundation of the Indian nation state. I say all of this to say that it makes me uneasy when people treat a big collection of people and voters as if they have no agency, as if they aren't smart enough to think through all the things that we do, you know, in our elite bubbles in big cities on talk shows and radio channels and TV shows and in magazines like mine. And we imagine that regular people aren't able to think through all of the same trade-offs. What I wanted to do in my essay is to make the case that maybe people have thought through these things, and maybe this is where they're coming out. Maybe they want to pick a leader who is a liberal, a leader who has a different vision of the country, who doesn't prioritize secularism or liberalism, but has a different vision of a Hindu-first state, and has a vision of new welfareism that people like. He's used the state to make people's lives better. I may not agree with any of this, but we have to grapple with the notion that demand is not static, it's dynamic, just as much as supply is dynamic. And you have to grapple with both sides of that equation if you want to truly understand what a country is and where it's headed.
Tensions between Canada and India have been high lately over the past year. Of course, this all sort of came to a boil when our Prime Minister Justin Trudeau stood up in our House of Commons and accused that the Indian government was involved in the killing of Canadian Sikh separatist activist Hardeep Singh Nijjar, who was killed in Surrey, British Columbia. New Delhi has denied this. It caused a lot of tension between our two countries. I'm wondering, has that had, this incident had an impact on how Modi is perceived in India, or gotten any sort of legs in India, so to speak?
So I think that there's something that Canadian people need to understand. If Prime Minister Trudeau's expectation when he made this accusation about the Indian government being behind the assassination of someone on Canadian soil, a Canadian citizen, if his expectation was that India would say, yes, we did it, we're sorry, then that was an incorrect assumption. If the assumption was that this would embarrass Modi because the Indian people would be shocked and horrified that India could do such a thing, that would also have been a misunderstanding of how Indians think about their leader and their place in the world. So India's denied having any involvement. In my own opinion, I'm imagining that Canada and Five Eyes would have had some reason to think that India played a role in assassinating Hardeep Singh Nijjar. Be that as it may, I have not seen the evidence. When India denies it, the general reaction in India was not to say Modi could be right or wrong. Their general reaction was, we didn't do it, but if we did the right thing. And it's really important for, I think, Canada to understand where India is at with this. India has a very different sense of its role in the world and foreign policy today than it did 10 years ago. Modi has turned India into a much more assertive, confident, muscular foreign policy country that is not aligned still as it used to be decades ago, but that is much more likely to assert its interests and to do what it needs to do to protect its interests, whether that is morally ambiguous or not. That's what New Delhi is trying to do, and it is incredibly popular. So it's just important to put that in context without really being able to weigh in on what actually happened, which I'm not privy to.
I was speaking with David Sanger, the New York Times White House and national security correspondent, earlier this morning on our program. And he was talking about, you know, the shifting geopolitical sands in the world and who's making alliances and partnerships with whom. And he mentioned India as sort of standing there looking at a buffet of options and picking and choosing depending sort of on the situation. We know that India has taken a strong position backing Israel in the conflict in the Middle East, but Narendra Modi continues to keep strategic relations with opposing sides in Washington and Moscow. So how are you looking at Modi, should he win another term, which he's expected to do, on the world stage and sort of in that geopolitical landscape?
I think India is trying to pick and choose in each particular instance what is in its best interest. So it wants to be friendly with America, in large part because there are tech ties and defense ties that it could gain from. But if America for a minute thinks that India would come to its help if it went to war with China over Taiwan, then it's sorely mistaken, because India would have no intention of doing so, because it wouldn't be in its interest to do so. It, after all, has its own problems with China and it doesn't want to rock the boat there. India likes to see itself as friendly with Washington, but of course it is protecting a much older friendship with Moscow. Moscow was New Delhi's friend when Washington wasn't, during the Cold War. But India isn't just protecting that old friendship out of loyalty. It's protecting it because it gets a good deal out of it. So before Russia invaded Ukraine, India was purchasing only 1% of Russia's total crude exports. That's because it wasn't priced right for India. Today, it is able to buy Russian oil on the cheap because everyone else has sanctioned Russia. And so it is purchasing 50% of Russia's total crude exports. It is advantageous for India to pick and choose the best deals that lie on the table without really taking into considerations morality or ideological consistency. Those are not things that New Delhi really cares about, partly because at its core, it thinks that nobody cares about it. It likes to point out ideological inconsistencies in Brussels, London, and Washington as well, which frankly these days have become more clear and open for all to see. And all of this that I'm describing is domestically immensely popular. So foreign policy in India used to be purely an elite consideration. It has become much more of a domestic consideration where regular people, they look at the choices India is making globally. And by and large, they like what they see. They like an assertive, muscular India that is rising as a so-called middle power amid relative American decline. And they like the idea that their country has more clout.
Ravi, I so appreciate your analysis and assessment of all of this. Thank you for making time for us today. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Ravi Agrawal is the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. As I mentioned, the election voting in India will take place over the next 6 weeks, so stay tuned to cbcnews.ca. The results will be declared on June the 4th. And that's it for the Sunday Magazine for this week. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Adam Killick, Pete Mitten, and Aronde Williams. Senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.